Greeting and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our program tonight, a conversation about Atul Gawande's Being Mortal and the issues it raises about life, death, and the quality of decisions we make within the context of our last days of life. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Patrick Abor, the director and founder of the Center for Elderly Suicide Prevention and Grief-Related Services at the San Francisco Institute on Aging. Dr. Patrick Abor brings years of experience in crisis intervention, suicide prevention, and aging. He lectures in the Department of Human Sciences at Notre Dame de Mira University in Belmont and the School of Social Welfare at UC Berkeley. Dr. Abor is the founder of the Friendship Line for the Elderly, a highly respected telephone service at the Institute for Aging for people in San Francisco and all over the world. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Patrick Abor.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you, Gerald, for that introduction. And I'm very happy to be here. I think I'd rather be talking about mortality than the drought. So I'm kind of glad I'm with this topic. And as Gerald said, I'm the director and founder of the Center for Elderly Suicide Prevention and Grief-Related Services, and the premier service is the Friendship Line, which began in 1973. And at the time, if we had 50 phone calls, we thought that was a lot. Now we get about, and that's in a month, and now we have about 8,500 incoming and outgoing calls for the month of February. So things are active there. And a lot of what people talk about is mortality, but they don't really have a vocabulary. You know, they're not sure how to go about having a discussion, and yet they know that somewhere inside of them, they have some fear, perhaps, some anxiety about death or mortality, not unlike what Dr. Irvin Yalom talks about in his book, Staring at the Sun. And when I found the book, as many of you, how many of you have read the book by Atul Gawande? Quite a few of you, and I was very struck by that book. And then when we at Institute on Aging started to do showings of the film, and Catlin, my colleague in the back there, and I have participated in those, and people have really turned out for that, and it really impressed me that you know. Not that long ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, when I would give a talk on death and dying, grief and loss, really nobody wanted to come. So I would have to call it something else like how to cope with aging in a healthy way. And then I'd talk about mortality and death and dying. And I was just hoping that my personality would kind of win them over so they wouldn't take off. And you know, so I know, you know, it's kind of a tough sell. And nowadays, though, we know, and some of you might have been to death cafes. How many of you have been to a death cafe? A couple of you. And so, you know, the fact that people are gathering together at a restaurant over their Pinot Noir and talking about death really inspires people like me, right? So it's really, again, a wonderful opportunity to be here with you this evening. And one of the things that Dr. Gawande says among many, if you've seen the film, you know, and read the book, he really is struggling with a number of things. And he says that the book, as well as the film, is about the modern experience of mortality, about what it's like to be creatures who age and die, how medicine has changed the experience and how it hasn't, where our ideas about how to deal with our finitude have got the reality wrong. And so in the book, but also in the film, he's really trying to find his own path as a surgeon, but also as a writer. And he does this by looking at a number of vignettes that he presents in the film with different people. There are, I think, five vignettes. And one of them, the first one he discusses, has to do with a younger couple where the wife is pregnant. And she, I think at the 9 month, she is going to deliver in a month. She has stage 4 lung cancer. And a lung collapses, and she's not able to have a section. They were very fearful that she could really possibly die. And so she had to push and deliver the baby on her own, which was really exhausting, but the baby, Vivian, survived. And what Dr. Gawande got involved with him kind of late in the game when she was diagnosed with a second cancer. And what he said to them was, you know, let's really find any kind of support medically that we could to extend your life. You know, what can we do to help you go on? And both the woman and her husband were very eager to try anything. And in the film, the wife has died, and the husband is, they're having a conversation, and Dr. Gawande was saying that we were trying, you know, any kind of procedure or medicine that would really extend her life. And he said, the husband said, yeah, you kind of colluded with us in terms of hope that we would find some way to kind of beat this, because everybody wants to be in that section of people that survive, you know, these cancers. And then Dr. Gawande said, but what I was doing was lying to you, that there she was not going to recover. And then the husband said, and then what we were not able to do was to really bond together, because she was so ill and she couldn't even hold the baby because of the chemotherapies and, you know, the other kinds of medical intervention they were utilizing. And that was very... you could see with Dr. Gawande that was very difficult for him to say. And then the husband said, you know, I could have a lawsuit. And he was kidding. But what came out was how physicians, in their effort to kind of beat this cancer, collude with the patient in terms of hope, when maybe there wasn't much hope alive, and that maybe it would have been better for her to be able to spend those couple months or whatever it might have been, you know, really being able to hold her baby and take care of the relationship. And that just wasn't able to happen. The next one that he discusses in a vignette is a 45-year-old man who also has brain cancer, and his wife, and how this gentleman was also struggling for any kind of, whether it's experimental drug, whatever he could get, that he really wanted to live, and he really wanted to beat this cancer. And again, with him, you know, that wasn't going to happen. And a, you know, and you could see with this gentleman, at one point he said, rather than having his physician, Dr. Nayak, you know, just tell him, you know, it's over. And he said, I would rather have had her shoot me than try to tell me bad news while being so nice. And he said, I'm at the end of my rope just wanted it to be over. And he felt really bad because he fought the cancer for as long as he could. Another vignette was with an older woman with her husband, and she also was terminally ill. But she didn't know that exactly. And what she really desperately wanted to do was to take her new grandchild who was very young, she wanted to take this child to Disneyland. And she said, you just have to make me well enough to take this trip with this grandbaby. And, of course, that didn't happen either. And what Dr. Gawande was then pondering was, you know, that the patient themselves may not realize, you know, the severity of their illness, and that, you know, there isn't going to be another act in their lives. And what do you do in a case like that? And then another individual that was facing terminal illness was Atul Gawande's father, who was also a physician. And he said a wonderful thing in this, among many things. He said, you know, here we are. I'm a physician. My father's a physician. And my mother's a physician. And we all had enormous difficulty talking about end of life. We just really struggled to have that conversation. And I thought that was really profound because that, you know, I see this often, is that people may want to have this conversation, but it's so difficult. And if our physicians are having trouble with that, how about us, just people, you know, who live in the community and have families? How do we initiate that conversation? And then the final person that they interviewed was a gentleman. His name was Jeff, and he was also very, very ill with cancer. And his desire was to be in the country at the farm so that he could die there. And, you know, and he was able to have that happen. But not without a lot of, you know, really struggling with how to say goodbye to his family. And there's a very poignant scene where his grandson, who might have been maybe 10 or 11, was saying goodbye to him. And it was very, and it just really illuminated how important goodbyes are and how important endings are. And we need to be able to talk about it. And he goes on to say, you know, there's two unfixables in life. We can't fix aging, and we can't fix dying, you know. And he said the story of aging is really the story of our body parts, you know, and that things start to change and wear down. And he was really making a really positive case for, you know, we need to pay more attention to what the patient wants and to depend on the physician as knowing what to do may not be the best course of action. There may need to be more of a collaboration. But it means that as patients, we need to find out and think about, how do we talk about this? You know, and I think it's very, very challenging. You know, my 43 years of work in the field of aging, it's just so hard to recognize that I am going to die, you know, that is real. And I feel like so many people live in the Disneyland of aging, you know, and we look at people 95, you know, and so they'll have them on Good Morning America or something like that. And it's like this person is doing really, really well and they're not sick and they're mentally just so sharp and so great. But that might not be me, you know, that might not be you. But then we compare ourselves to them and think, oh, I'm going to have that too. And we forget that may not be our story. It may be that person's story, but not our story. And we have to really think of it. What he says a number of times is, medicine is the easy part. Everything else is harder. You know, and I think that is very true. Gawande talks about, you know, how modern medicine has given us two revolutions. One is we've undergone a biological transformation of the course of our lives, and the other is we've undergone a cultural transformation of how we think about that course. You know, and we see all the time the fastest growing age category in America today is the 85 plus age category. So it's highly likely that those of us who are a little younger might see that we're going to be in our 80s. And the other fast growing age category is the 100 plus. And so we can sit and think, wow, we're going to be living a long time. But for those of you who might be 40, you're not going to be 40 for the next four decades. You're going to be 50, 60. You know, that's kind of the bad news. You know, and yet we have to face that. You know, that's what Irvin Yalom says in Staring at the Sun. We have to face, impermanence. We've got to be able to find ways to talk about that. And that's one of the reasons that Catlin and I have been doing these talks, is to just kind of, you know, stir people up that it's okay to talk about it, even though it might be scary, even though it might be hard to really talk about my own mortality. It might be easier for me to talk about somebody else's mortality than my own. And so we have to really, think about that. He also talks about the alternative to withering away in old age homes and dying in hospitals. You know, no matter how miserable the old system has been, we're experts at it. And so I really believe, as I hear all these stories from my clients or consumers about what's happened to their older parent in a rehab home or a convalescent place, how difficult it has been for them, how the care has not been very consistent or positive. And then I hear them having lawsuits. They're trying to, after their parent dies, and then it gets into all this legal stuff. Because what they are is very angry. Why did my older parent at 89 have to suffer so much at the end? Why was that? And so I think that, what Togawande is saying, we need to kind of check this out. We need to look, are there other options? That last point, you agree to become the patient. The doctor agrees to try to fix you despite the misery, damage, or cost. And it's very important what he's saying. There are at least two kinds of courage in aging and sickness. One is the courage to confront the reality of mortality, and then the courage to act on the truth we find. And that's, I think, very difficult. As again, and I'm sure you have all kinds of stories too about people that despite the fact that there is knowledge that the end is near, we'll try another chemotherapy, we'll do this other surgery. And forgetting about how painful recovery is at 75 or 82 or whatever it might be, that it's not easy to recover from these procedures. And then you're exhausted and life is really not very meaningful because I can barely say hello to somebody because I'm so exhausted, let alone trying to say goodbye. Gawande wonders, one has to decide whether one's fears or one's hopes are what should matter most. And so for human beings, life is meaningful because it's a story. A story has a sense of a whole, and its arc is determined by the significant moments, the ones where something happens. In stories, endings matter. And that's what I think has driven Dr. Gawande to write the book and to make the film, and trying to really acknowledge the importance for people to own their story rather than being so tired, so sick, that they really want the end then finally to happen, but they don't have an opportunity really to say goodbye, to acknowledge what it was like to live on this planet and have relationships and contribute. Very difficult. Accepting death comes with complex emotions. And those of you that work with people who are nearing death or people who are dealing with the death of loved ones, know it's very difficult. It brings up a lot. I'm always touched, and I don't mean this to be negative to younger people in the audience, but I teach, and so I have a lot of younger students, and we'll be talking about death and dying. And I'm always really amazed when they say, "I have no problem with death." And I said, "Well, if I were you, young and healthy, and feel like I have the world in front of me, I might say that too, and maybe I did. I don't say that anymore. But I think that we don't really sink our teeth into it, what it really means to leave this planet, and how often do we really have chances to explore that, in any kind of depth, where we could really, kind of get into or underneath our denial. and really think and consider what does that mean for our loved ones? What does that mean for ourselves? You know, do we have advanced directives? Do we have a living will? Are we clear with what our outcome is going to be? There's a wonderful book, and I am definitely a book person, and anybody that's been to my house, I know I have books everywhere. And this one, Swimming in a Sea of Death, is a memoir David Reif wrote about his mother, Susan Sontag. Has anybody read this book? It's in the on the list. It's a wonderful book. And what he talks about is for his mother, that she had cancer, as some of you know. Susan Sontag was so massive back in the 70s and 60s and 80s, and she had cancer, I think, in the 70s, and the cancer went into remission, and then it came back in the 90s again, or late 90s, and she had been a Buddhist and, you know, very aware of life and embracing life, and she was very sick with cancer, and he was very concerned that she wasn't looking at what's going to happen down the road. And you know, if you would die, what do you want done? Where do you want to be buried? I mean, she was, you know, rather famous, and so things, plans had to happen. But she wouldn't talk about it. She would not talk about death. And so when the doctors would say you could have a bone marrow transplant, she was in New York City, if you go to Seattle, you can have this bone marrow transplant, and there's a one in a million chance that you might benefit from it. And so if you read anything about Susan Sontag or seen her in that film about her, she went for it because she thought if anybody's going to be one in a million, it's going to be Susan Sontag. I mean, you know what I mean. And, you know, and I think that that's the thing. And he said to those oncologists, he said, why are you telling my mother that? And they said, well, there may be a one in a million chance. And Atul Gawande has said that too. And then he said, I don't say that anymore because I know there isn't. You know, and instead of, you know, going through all that to extend your life by maybe, 6 months or a year, maybe you could use that time to say goodbye, you know, to get some kind of closure. You know, I think that's very important. He talks about autonomy and premature death. Assisted suicide. Gawande states that we already recognize some form of this right when we allow people to refuse food or water or meds and treatment, even when the momentum of medicine fights against it. You know, and so, you know, we need to kind of be aware of that. You know, and he says, how is dying ever acceptable? How is it ever acceptable? We live for something bigger than ourselves. We need to find some kind of meaning. And he talks about shaping our stories, and you see in this film how he's really trying to see how do other surgeons or oncologists, and then he certainly talks about palliative care doctors who are much more willing and are trained to be able to talk about death, to talk about the end. Whereas many of the doctors in the film said, you know, we're trained to fix things, you know, and we see it as failure if the patient dies. And we don't like failure. Because we're trained to make it better, you know, and that's very powerful. You know, holding on to hope that isn't a hope is really awful, you know. And so patients want to believe that maybe, as the doctor, the oncologist who was working with Atul Gawande's father said, you know, hey, you know, maybe in 6 months you're going to be back playing tennis. And the mother said, that was so ridiculous to say that to him. And he, as a doctor himself, understood that that was ridiculous. I'm not going to be playing tennis again. I'm going to die. And let's just stop this. But it's very difficult. We'll sacrifice time now for the possibility of some time in the future. And then that doesn't happen. So Atogawande writes, our most cruel failure in how we treat the sick and the aged is the failure to recognize that they have priorities beyond merely being safe and living longer, that the chance to shape one's story is essential to sustaining meaning in life, that we have the opportunity to refashion our institutions, our culture, and our conversation in ways that transform the possibilities for the last chapters of everyone's lives. And that's why we at the Institute on Aging have been so immersed in this, showing this film in various counties, is to really try to help people find ways to talk about this, you know. And if we have loved ones who are ill or have dementia or stage 4 pancreatic cancer, whatever it might be, can we shift and actually have a conversation about what I feel as I see you approach end of life, and how do you feel? And can we talk about it? Again, I think it's not easy. At root, this debate, the debate is about what mistakes we fear most, the mistake of prolonging suffering or the mistake of shortening valued life. You know, how do we weigh that? And I know you know people who would say, and you see it all the time in the what I used to call obituaries, life tributes, which is not my favorite term. I think you died, and let's grieve or mourn over it rather than let's have a celebration. I said, my son is here, and I don't want a celebration of my life at the end. Well, he knows that. Can you imagine being my son? Oh, God. And this is what I talk about. You know, it's important. But I think it's okay for people to mourn and grieve, you know, and to acknowledge accomplishments. But it's okay to be sad and cry, you know, because I miss my loved one. Only a minority of people saved from suicide make a repeated attempt. And that's the other thing, is that we have to look at the difference between end of life, you know, I am ill, you know, and I don't want to endure any more medical treatments. But does that mean I want to kill myself, suicide? You know, and I appreciate in the book that he tries to separate that, that people who are suicidal may not necessarily be terminally ill. And we need to look at that. The terminally ill who face suffering that we know will increase, only the stone-hearted can be unsympathetic. And so that leads us to the End of Life Option Act. And I'm sure you're all familiar. Is everybody familiar with that? That Governor Brown signed it in January, and it goes into effect in July. And I think, you know, when people hear me say that I'm a founder of the Center for Elderly Suicide Prevention, they say, well, then you're not interested in, you know, helping people find a way to die with dignity. And that's like, that's not it, you know. At our friendship line, we're very supportive of people calling who want to have these conversations. It's important to have a dialogue about this. And it's important to really help people understand, is this fear that's driving you to want to die by suicide, or is it that you know that the end is coming medically, and that you want to really see what your options are. You know, California is now the fifth state in the union that has some sort of end-of-life option. The other states are Vermont, Montana, Washington, and Oregon, as you probably know. But there are other jurisdictions in the world that also have suicide laws or opportunities to end your life prematurely. This bill came 2 months after California resident Brittany Maynard, a 29-year-old diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, reignited the death with dignity debate when she moved to Oregon because she didn't feel that she could accomplish that here in California. And so she was very well known, and a lot of people were very supportive of her. Similar bills in California failed to pass the legislature, as you probably remember, back in 2005 and 2007, and then voters rejected a 1992 proposal that would have allowed physicians to administer lethal injections to their patients. The Assemblywoman Susan Eggman from Stockton, a former hospice worker, was the author of the legislation, and that gave me some hope, rather than have legislators themselves, even though she was one. But I liked her background. At least she had an understanding. I would much prefer a hospice worker or a social worker or, you know, a gerontologist, somebody that understands, rather than a legislator that really doesn't have that background. This legislation ends 10 years from now, at which time lawmakers could decide to extend it. And I'm not going to go into these details because the clock is ticking, but there are certain requirements that are important to comply with if you're going to apply for this particular type of death. Probably the most important thing there is that you have to have a terminal illness and that being diagnosed by two doctors and psychological evaluation for mental capacity if necessary. And then, you know, the rest of it there too. You need two witnesses to sign the request. Only one of the two may be related and only one may be employed at a healthcare facility. The other issue that comes up with end-of-life care has to do with withdrawal of life support. And a person in pain cannot continue to live without medical care or treatment. And so Terry Schiavo was the case that really brought things nationally and really got that debate moving very powerfully. She had a stroke that resulted in her being in a vegetative state from 1990 to 2005, and the feeding tube was finally removed, and she died within a week or two of that. And so, again, I think what Gawande is saying with his book, Being Mortal, is that, again, can we kind of close that story on our lives in a way that is going to be respectful, you know, and in a way that makes sense to the individual. And, you know, and again, assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide is a broad term used to describe the process of helping an individual end his or her life, a role typically granted to physicians. And this can be done by providing the individual with a syringe containing a lethal dose of a drug that will provide a peaceful but effective overdose. And as I said, there's a lot of jurisdictions in the world wherein assisted suicide has been approved, but they all have very kind of different laws, different limits, different rules. All but Switzerland forbid foreigners this type of help to die. And Switzerland, which I really never thought too much about until this, is that one can go there, you don't have to be a resident, and one could end their lives and it would be legal. They have, their laws are very different. But you see Colombia, Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands, England and Wales, Vermont, New Mexico, there's a court ruling under appeal, so they'll probably be the sixth state once that is taken care of, Quebec and Canada, and details are pending on their suicide issue. I like this Peanuts cartoon where Charlie Brown is sitting there and he says, "Someday we will all die, Snoopy." And Snoopy says, "True, but on all the other days, we will not." And I really like that when they're having this existential conversation sitting on the dock of the bay. And I thought that was interesting. The last thing, I know I just have a minute. I wanted to also, and I think that, I think her name is Lucille Kalanithi, the wife of the surgeon who wrote this book, When Breath Becomes Air. Has anybody read this? It's so good, isn't it? It's really, really worthwhile. And it has another kind of opportunity because in this, the surgeon is talking about his own impending death. And it's beautifully written and very, I think, realistic, but also with a sadness there because they do have a baby. And, you know, it's very powerful and very profound. And I saw that she's going to be speaking at some point here. And she would be worthwhile seeing. And what else did I wanted to say? Two things. What Atul Gawande was trying to communicate was that we're not equipped as physicians, for the most part, to deal with the end. And what we can do, all of us, is that we can start to begin a process where we do engage with, you know, our friends or family and others about the end, and not have to experience what David Reif had to experience regarding his the death of his mother, who, again, up until the end, never did say what she wanted. And he said that that was quite a problem. And we know other families who struggle with this because the individual who was dying never took the time, because it's so depressing, people say, to talk about end of life and what do I want to have happen. And he was very concerned about this. And so he didn't know, but he writes, Nietzsche describes the melancholy happiness he derives from the spectacle of human beings loving life and rejecting the thought of death. It is as if he loves them for their gallantry, since they will all be extinguished sooner rather than later. His observation consoles me in some way. I can neither entirely explain nor entirely justify why that pleases me. In one of her own journals, in an entry written during the period when she was receiving chemotherapy at Memorial Sloan Kettering for her breast cancer, my mother enjoined herself to be cheerful, be stoic, be tranquil. And then she added, in the valley of sorrow, spread your wings. This was not the death, however, that she died. But in the end, I think that what she said, whether she entirely believed it or not, whether any of us can come to entirely believe it or not, is the best that can be said of old mortality. In the valley of sorrow, spread your wings. Thank you.
Our thanks again to Dr. Patrick Abor. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please line up behind the mic that I'm currently at and speak directly into the microphone as we are recording.
So don't hesitate. Let's go. I know you all have questions.
Thank you. First question, life is a story, and that was very telling in what you said. Are there any groups, or are you aware of anything that is assisting people as they approach death and are interested, but perhaps aren't as talented as some people in telling their stories and how much spreading your wings in that period of time would assist families in hearing that story? Is there any movement that's bringing that to the fore for people that are approaching death?
I think there are a number of groups. The group that pops up first to me is hospice, because with hospice care, if that pain can be remediated in some way, so that the individual can think and not feel so exhausted by their illness, that I think hospice is a really good place to go, and to be able to get the support that you might need in order to be able to talk with your family, with your loved ones, about what's happening to you. The other group is, some of you are probably familiar with, is Compassionate Care at End of Life. They also provide structure and support for people who might be wanting to talk about those issues as well. So I think that there are places to go and that can be helpful to begin a dialogue. Sometimes that can happen through pastoral counselors, rabbis, priests, others may be willing to participate. Jewish Healing Center here in San Francisco have rabbis who are more than willing to help support in that conversation. So I think that there are groups that are available and are willing to do it. I don't think there's nearly enough, but I think that there are some that can be very helpful in terms of beginning those conversations.
Dr. Arbour, thank you very much for covering such a difficult topic in such a short amount of time. But as there's so many people here, and you did put the number up there for the Institute on Aging, could you please give a little oversight or overview of what the IOA could help people with concerning this topic and other things? Please.
Yeah, I thank you. I think the Institute on Aging is a resource, and in the handout, I think towards the end, I have a number that you can call. It's IOA Connect. But Institute on Aging and Catlin and our other staff member would be very happy to talk to you. We have a lot of handouts there, and they're very willing to engage in these difficult conversations. And we have social workers and psychologists and psychologist interns who are willing to do that. I also facilitate our traumatic loss groups, where we often have people that drop in our Saturday morning group, not because their person has died, but their person is still alive, and they just don't know what to do. One of our many of our questions that come up in that group is sometimes that my elderly mother or grandmother or whoever it is saying, again, like Atul Gawande said about that one gentleman, said, why don't you just shoot me? Well, that's very hard to hear if you're the daughter, you know, if you're the son, and you see that your mother or whoever it is really having a terrible time with pain and with just the agony, the anxiety of not knowing what to do with the end coming so close. You know, there was a wonderful social worker I met, and she wrote an essay about how she looked at death now, and she was 92 when she wrote this. And she says in there, I got to the point where death moved into my neighborhood, and I'm not able to move away. And she said, that's when I started to talk about death. But she said at 92, nobody wanted to hear it. And yet, death was right there. So Institute on Aging, and again, at the end, if you want to speak to Catlin, that she has information back there for you.
Hi, I'm Sharon Martz. I actually did my dissertation on caregiving, multigenerational care, and both my parents passed away from Parkinson's, so it was about a 20-year progress till their death. But I found when I worked at a hospice that doing an ethical will had been really helpful at any age to just right. reflect on one's life. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that we're never too young to look at death and impermanence, you know, and then, you know, if you're in your 20s or 30s, whatever, I think it's a really good exercise to start to realize that, you know, life is about impermanence. And many of you probably remember when you turned 30, and you might have said to yourself, I am so old. How could that be? You know, and Dr. Yalom would say, those round birthdays get us. But he said, there's a window of opportunity that says, yeah, I'm recognizing impermanence, maybe for the first time. And maybe it would be good to think about that, you know, and look at, you know, what it will mean one day that I might have to leave this planet. You know, Maury Schwartz, if you remember Maury Schwartz from when he was on, and there are enough people with my kind of hair that I know you know this, Ted Koppel on Nightline, and he was on there four times. And he said, you know, he said, well, one of the things he said to Ted Koppel that I thought was very funny was when they first started talking, Ted said, I think you had some concerns about me as the interviewer. And he said, yeah, he said, I think you're very narcissistic. And I thought that was really quite challenging. He said, you have to grieve for yourself. You have to mourn the approaching end. and to be able to talk about it and convey how that feels, the disappointment or the sadness or the sorrow that comes up with having to relinquish your connection on this planet. And he said, we just don't do that enough. So I really like what you were saying, that I think we need to educate, you know, younger people that it's okay to have this conversation. It's okay to plan, and then you're going to update it down the road. But many of you in this room, I'm sure, have had losses. And one of the things that we work with at Institute on Aging is sudden death, traumatic loss. And in many of our groups, right now I have a couple whose 19-year-old daughter died in a terrible accident on, what is that, Highway 17 coming from Santa Cruz. That's such an awful place. And it was a one-person vehicular accident. What she was trying to do was get out of the way of another car. And she lost control of hers, and it went down this ravine and into the ocean. 19. You know, of course, nobody anticipates that a 19-year-old is going to die, but she did, and she's not alone. You know, sudden death can hit any of us, and I'm sure there are people in this room who have had, you know, very significant losses, and even me just talking about this might start triggering some difficult or complex emotions. And yet, I think that we need to be prepared. You know, we just never know. Yes?
Hi. At the beginning, you gave the example of the pregnant mother who was dying and talked about the conversations with the husband afterwards where the doctor said, yeah, I was lying to you. So the alternative to lying is to be brutally honest and to say to someone, you ain't going to make it. What are your reactions to it, a physician that says that and sort of takes away any, I don't know, hope?
Well, thank you for that question. How many of you have seen the film? Some of you have seen the film. So what he was talking about was that, yeah, many surgeons or oncologists or doctors may not be trained properly in terms of how to have that particular conversation. And so there's a physician in there, a palliative care physician, who is joining like the oncologist or the surgeon in talking to the individual, and she was really quite thoughtful and very kind and very gentle, and what she was saying, and Dr. Gawande was acknowledging too, that the patient kind of knows. And she says to this one woman in that one of the vignettes, she said, I think you know it's gotten worse. And she said, you know, you really have to check with the patient about their perception of their disease. And they may have a sense of it, but they're afraid to talk about it. But if you can say, you know, I feel too that the disease has gotten much more aggressive. And then you start a conversation. What I also liked in the film, if you remember when she's talking to that lady, she had her hand on her knee. That touch, I thought, was so really lovely that I'm connecting with you. And she said to the woman, she said, and we're going to be with you till the end. Because of your complications of your symptoms, you're not going to be able to go home. So we're going to take care of you right here. And it was really gentle and very, very thoughtful. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of doctor I would like to have if I was nearing end of life. Somebody who would tell me the truth, as you're saying, but not be brutal, you know, and understand that I might not be able to comprehend the end right now. I might not even be able to track what you're saying because I'm so far invested in denial. Do you know what I mean? But the palliative care doctor, and that's what she models at this hospital in Boston, is there is a way to have the conversation. And it was just very striking, as you remember when you saw the film, that it almost looked like we were talking about it, that it looked like a business arrangement with the ones that didn't have this training. And it was not, you know, warm. And yet the palliative doctor was modeling warmth and connection. It was more of a collaboration, as I said earlier, rather than I'm the doctor and the only thing I can do is prescribe medicine and treatments. But outside of that, there isn't much else I can do. And that's when I think the hopelessness really ignites. Rather than we'll be with you, we're an ally, you know, and we're going to support you until the end. And I think that's another beautiful way to enter into the dying process. Yes?
I wonder if you've seen the film All That Jazz.
I did.
Very good. It's by Bob Fosse, and I think he made it less than a year before he himself died. What I see in the film is that death is a drama. Do you think that way, that death needs to be a drama?
Well, good. I'm glad you asked that question because I have to think about that for a moment. I don't know if I would say kind of a drama, but I think it's an invitation to face the unknown. And that might mean we have to be creative about that in terms of, you know, what I learned, maybe if you went to Catholic school or were raised in the Jewish tradition or the Protestant tradition, are your thoughts about spirituality, are they the same as they were when you were little, or do you need to upgrade them? You know, we upgrade our phones like that, but do we upgrade our beliefs? And I think many times not. And so we go into that scared out of our mind about what's going to happen, rather than curious and interested and being able to kind of be as thoughtful about it as possible. And that's why on your handouts, you know, I have a lot of books on death that I found very inspiring and helpful. So I think the more we learn about death, the more we can face our fears. And if that is drama, well, then maybe that is. But I think it's worthwhile participating in our end of life. Thank you.
I have a friend who is 80 years old and is at least 5-6 years surviving cancer. He and his wife died of cancer, so he knows some of the symptoms, et cetera, at the end. He is on a chemo medication that's experimental, and it's very expensive. And so what he would like to do is travel. However, the expense of the medication prevents him from doing what he would like to do, which is travel. And when he asks his oncologist about getting off of this medication, even though he's completely free of any cancer, he is told, well, we really don't know what the effect is if you go off, because it's experimental. We haven't done it long enough on enough people. So my question is, in a sense is, and you can't actually tell me what to do, but your thoughts on how I can give him some information where to go, how to think about this, because it's easy for me to just say, oh, do what you want to do, right, you know, and so on. So I'd like to have your thoughts on that.
See, I think as a friend, I think it is really helpful to allow a conversation that looks at hope and also looks at limitations and allow your friend to be able to talk about that. What does it mean to me if I'm not able to travel? What does it mean if I can't do that one more trip to Italy or wherever it might be? That might not be on the table. You know, and how would I manage that? You know, and to see whether or not he could have a more strategic discussion with his doctor, because again, in the film, you see some of these doctors are they just don't want to say you're not able to do this, you cannot travel, and it's that kind of hope you know, that, well, maybe, maybe, maybe. But the patient is left with, well, is it or isn't it? You know, can I or can't I? So I would also urge the person to really have a very strategic talk with his doctor and really ask the doctor, is this an option for me? And if it isn't, that's where I think you come in terms of a friend, and let him grieve the loss of that thought that I could take one more trip abroad. Well, the oncologist may not want to take the risk, and that's why he might want to ask for somebody else, you know. Yes?
Hi. First thing I wanted to say is that I think all surgeons lie. I've had a number of sports injuries, and they always tell me I'm going to be 100%, and it's never been true. So just wanted to start there. But this notion of how you deal with telling somebody that someone's going to die is something. When my father started to die, he was in nursing care, and I was really concerned, and I went to the head nurse and said, gosh, he's not eating anymore. You know, I mean, what should we, you know, is there something you can do? And she closed the door, and she said, Mr. Ryder, look, your dad's dying, okay? And for some reason, it hadn't occurred to me, even though he's like, that's what he's doing, you know?
Right.
And so I cried a little bit, and then I looked up at her, and I said, how big of an idiot am I? Of course he's dying. And she said, you're about as big an idiot as every child that's ever come in here with a dying parent. And so what I wanted to say, though, is that so after that happened, when he did die, and they were asking, do you want us to give him some more morphine? I knew what they were talking about. And I said, yes, absolutely. So it wasn't legal back then.
Right.
But there's so many people that do understand and do that. But if she hadn't pulled me aside to, like, hit me in the head, I wouldn't have known that.
Right.
And so it was huge for me.
Well, and see, someone like that who actually tells the truth is really so helpful to the rest of us. Yes?
This is our last question.
Okay, thank you.
I will be brief. My difficulty is that when a family member who is very ill and knows he's dying and is wanting to talk about it and is very worried about what his poor wife is going to do when he's gone because he's taken care of everything. But the family members are totally in denial and resistant to letting him talk about it and to share his feelings and experiences. So that I think is a really, I haven't really heard that discussed. So I guess I want your answer for that.
Well, you know, again, I think that hospice, as you were saying, is a organization that can really help facilitate that kind of discussion and help people in a gentle way move through their denial. I think denial is there because I'm afraid of something. I'm afraid to face something. And so I think to have trained people who are comfortable with that, you know, people who are willing to talk about end of life and have experience. And how do we look at this, and how do we support each other? Because the end that happens for the individual is that I may have died, but my survivors have to grieve my loss. And so that's where I think grief counseling can also be an option, and hospice does that as well. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Patrick Abor. We'd also like to thank our audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you very much.